This week's episode starts with a bit of a disclaimer for us.
Yeah.
A couple of days ago, well, a week ago now, the world as we know it changed. We've been going through a lot of upheaval recently, but this was a pivotal moment in history because Prince Philip, Duke of Edinburgh, and husband and consort to Queen Elizabeth II sadly died.
We know that there has been a lot of opinions about him. I wouldn't say the country's divided, because I think there's a lot more people on for him and the Queen than there aren't. So we just want to say that it's probably no surprise to anyone that we are royalists. We love the monarchy. We've done a lot of podcasts about kings and queens of the past from all over the world.
Yeah.
And we will continue to do so.
We respect that some people might not be of that opinion.
Mm-hmm.
So what we're going to do today is we're going to talk about Philip. We're going to talk about the man, his life, because we realised we don't know that much about him,
no,
to be honest.
He led an extraordinary life. He did.
Yes, so much.
So much that we didn't even know.
Yeah.
So if you don't like Philip and you don't care about this podcast, then please stop listening. We don't want any messages. We don't. Quite frankly, I personally don't massively care if you want to message and tell us that he's a horrible person, because there's no need. Just be kind or don't say anything at all. But if you also, on that same thing, if you don't like him but you're intrigued, please listen on. There's a lot more behind him than what the press would lead you to believe.
Yeah. So
without further ado,
let's get historical.
Yep.
Sort of ish.
Yeah.
So as we said, there can't be a whole lot of places in the world that haven't really heard of the death of Prince Philip, Duke of Edinburgh, husband to Queen Elizabeth. And as we were actually researching this podcast, we were watching the run-up to the funeral yesterday. So, firstly, it is a loss of an elderly man, a husband, father, grandfather, great-grandfather, etc. So irrespective of your thoughts on the man, please remember that.
Yeah, he was someone's husband of 73 years. He was a father to four, a grandfather to, seven, I think, and nine great-grandchildren.
Yeah.
So, remember that he was so much more than just a prince.
Yeah, and don't get us wrong, we are going to talk about some of the things he did that were slightly less than PC.
Yeah.
But let's talk about the man as well as the prince.
Cool. So, the early years of Prince Philip.
He was born in Corfu, which is in Greece, on the 10th of June 1921 at the villa of Monrepos, on the dining table, no less. He was actually born on a dining table.
Wow.
Yeah. At birth, he was sixth in line to the Greek throne and also in line to the Danish throne.
Yeah, that was through because his father was Prince Andrew of Greece and Denmark, descended from George I of Greece and Christian XI of Denmark.
Yeah, and his mother was Princess Alice of Battenberg, who was granddaughter, of Queen Victoria of England. And both Philip and his later wife, Elizabeth, are great-great-grandchildren of Queen Victoria.
So technically they are cousins, they're related.
Yeah, they're a couple of times removed through family. But that's quite common in royals.
Mm-hmm.
He was the youngest of five children and the only boy in the family. His older sisters were Margarita, Theodora, Cicely and Sophie.
That's quite a lot to be the only boy.
Yeah.
And the youngest.
A prominent family as well. Yeah.
A lot of pressure on him.
Yeah, definitely. From a very young age. He was originally baptised into the Greek Orthodox Church at St. George's in Corfu. And his godparents were Queen Olga of Greece, Crown Prince George of Greece, Lord Louis Mountbatten, and Alexandros Kokotos, who was the mayor of Corfu.
So quite prominent figures then.
Yeah.
Yep. Philip didn't spend too long in Greece, however. His first time in England was for the memorial of his grandfather, Prince Louis of Battenberg, Marquess of Milford Haven.
Yeah. Because of the First World War, there was a lot of anti-German sentiment in the UK, so they decided to change the surname from Battenberg, I like the cake, mm-hmm, to the anglicised version, which is Mountbatten.
Which is obviously the one that we know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's where that name came from. But meanwhile, back home, the Greco-Turkish War, which was 1919 to 1922, was ongoing, but it was not going well for Greece.
No.
The then king, King Constantine I, who was Philip's uncle, was held accountable and he was actually forced to abdicate on the 27th of September 1922, which is a big deal.
Yeah. Prince Andrew was then arrested and because of executions of other officials involved, his life was very much at risk. To Alice and the children, to Alice is in Prince Philip's mother, was placed under surveillance. So yeah. they were then watched.
Some of the others that were involved, there was a thing called the Trial of the Six, and they were executed. So for a while, there was a genuine belief that Prince Andrew, Philip's dad, would be executed as well.
Yeah.
However, in December 1922, a sentence of exile for life from Greece was passed against Andrew, and the family was evacuated aboard the HMS Calypso, which was a British frigate at the time that was there. And Philip, because he was still a baby at this point, he was actually kept in a makeshift cot made from an orange box.
Aww.
Yeah. So that's why in like the TV series The Crown, they talk about him being smuggled out of Greece in a box of oranges. Yeah, that was because his cot was a fruit box. The family then settled in Saint-Claude in Paris, in France, and they lived in a house that belonged to Philip's aunt, who was Princess Georges of Greece and Denmark.
So you said that was December 1922?
Yeah.
He was born in June 1921.
Yeah.
So at 18 months old, he's already gone through all of that.
Yeah, he'd already been forced to leave his home, and just basically his family were essentially fleeing for their lives. It's like they're exiled from Greece if they go back, potentially under threat of death.
Yeah, that's crazy. So that was his early life. So now we go on to his education.
Mm-hmm.
His education started at the Elms in Paris until 1930, when he was sent to a charm school in England. Whilst there, he lived with his grandmother, Victoria Mountbatten, and his uncle, George Mountbatten, the second Marquess of Milford Haven.
Yeah, so Victoria Mountbatten was a dowager Marquess. Whilst he was in England, his sisters then moved to Germany with their new husbands, prominent German princes. His father and mother separated, and his father moved to Monte Carlo, and his mother, Alice, was not long after diagnosed with schizophrenia and was actually committed and placed in an asylum. So at that point, like, his family's dispersed everywhere. He's living with relatives in England. He's been kicked out of his home, his place of birth. He can't even speak his native language. And his parents have separated and his mum's been committed to an asylum.
And that's pretty hard. And he's on his own at this point. He's yeah. the only one in England now. His family is in Germany, Monte Carlo, and, like you said, in an asylum.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, he's barely, what, 10 years old?
Yeah.
He was then sent to Germany in 1933, and, like, I know I normally do pronunciations, but your German is better than mine. So, tell me if I'm saying this right.
Okay.
He attended the Schule Schloss Salem.
Yep.
Sweet. And that was actually owned by his brother-in-law, Berthold, who is a Margrave of Baden, and run by a gentleman called Kurt Hahn.
Yes, kind of remember that name, it will come up again.
Yeah.
And, at this time, there was, obviously, a rise of Nazism.
Yeah, 1933 was when Hitler became Chancellor in Germany, didn't he?
Yeah, and obviously it was, what, 4 years? No, I can't count. 6 years before the beginning of World War II.
Yeah.
I forgot how to count from 33 to 39. and so, obviously, because of this, Hahn, like we said before, Kurt Hahn, was Jewish, and he was obviously forced to flee. He ended up in Scotland, where he founded a new school there called Gordiston.
Yeah.
And Hahn, like we said, would then become a great influence on Philip throughout of his life.
Yeah. Philip himself actually also moved to Gordiston because he only ended up staying for 2 terms at the Schule Schloss school before moving there.
Yeah, 2 terms in, like, English it's and Germany and, like, Europe, it's normally about...
It's about 2/3 of a year.
More yeah, so that's six... Yeah. 6 to 8 months was all he stayed at that school for. Yeah,
so not long at all.
No.
But we know that he could speak German, he could speak French as well as English.
Yeah.
But not so much Greek.
No.
Unfortunately, then, tragedy did strike in 1937. His sister Cecily and her husband, George Donatus, the Grand Duke of Hesse, and her 2 sons, Ludwig and Alexander, were killed outright in an air crash at Ostend, along with her mother-in-law, Princess Eleonora of Solms-Hohenzollern-Lich. Did I say it? I think that sounds right.
Yeah.
They were members of the Nazi Party.
Yep, so... Yeah. Not great
but
at all.
They were still his family.
Yeah.
So in one fell swoop, he lost his sister, his brother-in-law, his 2 nephews.
Yeah.
Gone.
Which to anybody is a huge loss to lose all in one go.
But that wasn't all.
No.
He then, in 1938, lost his uncle, George Mountbatten, to bone marrow cancer. His other uncle, Louis Mountbatten, George's younger brother, then took up the duty of looking after Philip, and he would actually be an influence for the rest of Louis's life, so the rest of as long as Louis lived.
Yeah. So that's quite a vast education.
Yeah, he moved around a lot.
Yeah, many different places, which is why I guess he was quite, what is it, trilingual? What did you say he spoke?
Trilingual, I think, yeah. Three. So he was like Paris, Scotland, Germany, and then later on down to England.
So he could speak a lot of languages. He was quite well educated,
mm-hmm.
Which then led him to be able to join. He joined up to the military.
Mm-hmm.
He left Goldiston in 1939, prominent date there, and joined as a cadet at the Royal Naval College in Dartmouth. He then rejoined his mother in Athens for a month before being asked by King George II of Greece to return to his naval training. He graduated from Dartmouth in 1940 with the distinction of being the best cadet on his course. Now, he wouldn't have been given that because of who he was.
No.
He earned that. He would have been given that because he was the best cadet.
Yeah. The one thing, I mean, there is a level of privilege amongst, like, officers to an extent. But he started as a naval cadet, so he would have been treated as any other naval cadet.
Yeah.
So he earned that. Mm-hmm. He then served as part of the British forces during the Second World War, which was 1939 to 1945. And he started as a midshipman in January 1940, which is the lowest officer rank in the British Navy.
So he was still an officer, so he was above, like, your corporals, your lance corporals, your sergeants. But it was the lowest officer.
Yeah, so as far as officer goes, he's working from the ground up.
Mm-hmm.
He spent the next 4 months on the HMS Ramillies, which was tasked with protecting the convoys of the Australian Expeditionary Force in the Indian Ocean.
Yep, he then spent the next...
Yeah, so after those four months on the Ramillies? Yeah.
Yeah, so I had a drink. I got stuck in my throat. He then went on and was posted to HMS Kent and the HMS Shropshire, and then transferred to the HMS Valiant in the Mediterranean Fleet following the Italian invasion of Greece in October in 1940.
Yeah. So not only is he serving for the British military against the Axis forces, he's also now gone to see the place where he was born be invaded by the enemy.
Yeah. And at this point, if you think about it, the enemy were half of his family.
Yeah.
Because we said his sisters married German princes and were parts of the Nazi party, because he had two sisters in Germany. So yes, we heard that one died, but there was still another sister that was in the Nazi party, and he was fighting against them.
Well, directly in some places, because two of his brother-in-laws actually had commanding positions in the German Navy. So he was directly fighting against his own family.
Yep.
The Valiant, on the 1st of February 1941, he then attended further training at Portsmouth and was commissioned as a sub-lieutenant. And he was actually involved in the Battle of Crete and the Battle of Cape Matapan, where he had an honourable mention in dispatches for controlling the searchlights. So basically he was mentioned high command for doing really, really well. And he was given the Greek War Cross.
Which is an honour.
Yeah.
He was then involved with the Allied invasion of Sicily in 1942 aboard the HMS Wallace. In October of 1982... So the war is over. It's
1942. Sorry. That was my mistake. That was a spelling mistake. Sorry.
Great.
That's why I shouldn't be left with dates. I don't do numbers.
It's cool. It's not like history is important with dates or anything.
I know. I'm sorry.
So in October 1942, he became one of the youngest first lieutenants in the Royal Navy. He was still aboard the Wallace, and he actually saved his ship from an attack by night bombers by launching a raft full of smoke floats to distract them, which then let the ship escape.
Yeah.
So basically he saved an entire ship and himself.
He came up with the idea and helped execute it. So, yeah, he saved the entire ship. He just allowed them to slip off.
Yeah, that is so clever as well.
Yeah.
Like, to think that quickly and under that much pressure, because you know that these people are coming to bomb us. Oh, crap, what can I do?
Mm-hmm. And it could be over in seconds. I mean, if a bomb hits the right part of a ship, it's over.
Yeah.
He then moved on to the HMS Whelp in 1944 and served as part of the British Pacific Fleet. And because of that, he was actually in Tokyo Bay at the signing of the Instrument of Japanese Surrender. So he was there to witness the official end of the Second World War.
That's pretty crazy.
He then returned on the Whelp to the UK in 1946 and became an instructor at the HMS Royal Arthur School in Wiltshire.
Right. So before we go on to anything further now, we now know that this, his life so far has consisted of moving around, kind of quite a lot of tragedy, quite a lot of unfortunate circumstance, a lot of upheaval, and a lot of then joining the military against his family, those that he loved. Because yes, they did bad things, but you don't, they're still family, there's still love there. Even if he hated them, there'd still be love there because your family, your blood.
Yeah.
And all of that is what this man has had to go through.
Yeah, and that's before he, like, he served in a war. He would have seen people die. He may have even had to kill people.
Mm-hmm.
He would have come across all of that before he was, like, in his 30s.
Yeah.
So for the majority of his life, I saw when we were researching this something they called him the peripatetic prince, which means he's moving around everywhere. And he doesn't stay in any place for long. So he's never really had a home, never really had anyone to settle down. His family is fractured all across Europe, and some of them are fighting directly against him, or some of them are dead. He's got nowhere, he's got no one, really.
Until
1939.
Yep.
In 1939, the then King, George VI, and his wife, Queen Elizabeth, toured the Royal Naval College at Dartmouth. Whilst they were there, Philip was asked by both the Queen and his uncle, Louis Mountbatten, to act as an escort to the two young princesses, Elizabeth and Margaret.
Yep. Elizabeth at the time was 13. So you're at quite an impressionable age.
Yeah.
And she was charmed by this handsome young man. He was 18, so there's a five-year difference between them. And he, in turn, was given to showing off before her.
Yeah, like, there was this, I was watching a documentary about it the other day, and apparently there's, like, a little obstacle course or something there, and he was doing it, and he was really showing off to her, as a boy would to pretty young girls.
Yeah.
They started to exchange letters, and a bond formed between the two that only then seemed to strengthen.
Yeah, we do want to stress at this point that, yes, Elizabeth was 13 and he was 18. The bond was nothing.
It was just friendship at that point.
Yeah, definitely was just friendship.
Yeah, they grew really, really close.
Yeah.
And then the war happened, and obviously they both had to grow up pretty damn quickly during the war. So his late teens, early 20s were spent in combat.
Yeah, and Elizabeth she didn't see action, but she served as, she was driving ambulances, was like a mechanic in the Second World War.
Yeah, and to so people she out there that say, well, oh, she was mollycoddle and everything. No, she was getting right there in there.
They both were.
Yeah, she can strip a Jeep down in minutes.
I bet she still could.
Yeah, probably. but yeah, so they both kind of, they still kept in touch when they could, but they put it all aside and then regrouped afterwards.
Yeah, there was more important things at the time. But we said afterwards, in 1946, Philip then approached King George to ask for his daughter's hand in marriage. The king agreed, but asked that a formal announcement was not made before April 1947, when Elizabeth turned 21.
Yeah, so they had to wait for her to formally come of age to reach her majority to make that announcement.
Yeah, so she was 20 when he asked to marry her, and 21 when it was officially announced that they were getting married, they were engaged, betrothed.
So they'd been talking to each other, and they built this friendship, this relationship.
Over 7 years.
Love into 7 years.
Yeah. So they've been married, obviously we're now at 73 years, but this was 7 years before that.
Yeah, so 80 years.
That incomprehensible.
Yeah.
But anyways.
Philip took on the surname Mountbatten.
Yeah.
And became a naturalised British subject in March 1947. And the formal announcement of the engagement then came on the 10th of July 1947. Philip was then officially rebaptised from the Greek Orthodox Church into the Church of England in October 1947. And that was to allow him to marry Elizabeth.
So that is before they got married. He's already changed his name and changed his faith for the woman that he loved.
Yeah.
And this is the beginning of seeing how much he loved her, they loved each other, because he changed and allowed so much for her.
Yeah. But obviously he couldn't marry her as he was, because even though he wasn't technically a commoner, he was still beneath her.
Yeah.
So he had to be increased in rank. Mm-hmm. So on the 19th of November 1947, which is the day before the wedding, Philip was given the title His Royal Highness, Prince Philip, by King George, and was made Duke of Edinburgh, Earl of Merioneth, and Baron Greenwich on the morning of the 20th of November. So actually on the day he was given those titles. And then they were married later on that day. And in between that time, he actually, because he was already a Knight of the Garter by this point, he had that weird position where he was His Royal Highness, Prince Philip, Sir, like Sir Knight. And it's just like he's a prince and a knight at the same time. So, you know, to all the royal title people out there, I forgot the actual word of them, the name of them, their minds would just be like, what is going on right here? But yeah, and their ceremony was quite major.
Yeah, it was the first royal wedding to be broadcast on TV through the BBC. It was broadcast live from Westminster Abbey to an audience of more than 200 million globally. Now, that is a huge number now. Back then, in 1947...
And to be broadcast live as well, where they didn't have the technology we do
and
now.
Not many people actually owned TVs.
Yeah.
But it was still watched by 200 million people.
People were gathering around in TVs and big sports halls and everything.
Insane.
The street parties, you name it.
Yeah, so that number's probably way more.
Oh, yeah,
way
definitely.
More. But notably, however, none of Philip's sisters or any of his German relations were allowed to attend.
I kind of get
which
that.
Which you can understand.
I mean, it was like 2 years after the war.
Yeah, and there isn't actually any... what's the word I'm looking for? There isn't anything that we can find that says whether what his opinion was of this.
Yeah, there's no record of it.
Yeah, that's the word.
So as the Duke and Duchess of Edinburgh, Philip and Elizabeth resided at Clarence House, where they welcomed their first two children, Prince Charles in 1948 and Princess Anne in 1950. Philip was admitted to the House of Lords on the 21st of July 1948 and stayed there, and Charles actually joined him as a member of the House of Lords as well, up until Parliament decided no in 1999 that the royals shouldn't have any say in the House of Lords. We'll keep our opinions on that to ourselves. And then Philip was able to return to his naval work following the honeymoon, and he actually started with a job at the Admiralty, which was a desk job, before moving on to the Naval Staff College at Greenwich.
The young couple then moved to Malta in Villa Guardamangia.
Guardamangia.
There we go.
That's nice try there.
Thank you. See, you're better at words.
You're better at numbers.
There we go. We that's why we work. So, yeah, they moved there when Philip was stationed in Malta in 1949 as the first lieutenant of the HMS Chequers. He was then promoted to lieutenant commander in July of 1950 and had his first command, which is the HMS Magpie.
And he has a model of the HMS Magpie in his office at Buckingham Palace to this day.
Yeah, because that's like, as a naval officer, that is the goal. The goal is to man your own ship.
Yeah.
And he had it. He did it. And this is what he kind of expected to do for a lot of years.
Yeah.
This was supposed to be the first of many.
However, life had other plans.
Yeah.
And poor King George was starting to get ill.
Yeah.
In November 1951, Philip and Elizabeth went on a tour of Canada. They were really well received. And when they returned, they were both promoted to the Privy Council, which is basically the senior advisors to the reigning monarch. They're like his closest advisors.
Yeah.
And then in January 1952, Elizabeth and Philip started a tour of the Commonwealth, and they visited all the countries that made up the Commonwealth at that time.
Yeah. And this is where the crown is actually quite close, I guess, because there's a lot of records of this beginning of their life together. Because the crown is quite accurate with Claire Foy and Matt Smith is the king in as Philip and Elizabeth in this, isn't it?
Yeah.
So on the 6th of February 1952, they were in Kenya at the Sangana Lodge.
Mm-hmm.
And it was Philip who had to break the news to Elizabeth that her father had died and that she was now queen and that their lives were now never, ever going to be the same ever again.
Yeah, because obviously with his death, there was a lot of documentaries, a lot of information run. And one of the things was from the person who told Philip that George had died. Apparently, he looked stunned and he looked like the weight of the world had just come down on him.
Yeah, because they had these plans that, yes, they got married, what, she was 25, he was 30. They thought the king was quite young.
Yeah.
They thought they had at least another 20 years before Elizabeth would have to think about being queen. Mm-hmm. They had 20 years of him to be in the Navy, to live in Malta, to raise their family, to be husband and wife.
And then boom.
So as queen, Elizabeth now could not have anyone before her, even her own husband. Philip would never be king, only ever queen consort. But this meant other things as well.
Yeah. And this was the whole debate that went on with, like, with Victoria and Albert as well, in that as queen, you were the head of the country. You were basically the female king.
Yeah.
Obviously. But your husband in the church would always be above you. Your husband would be your master. Mm-hmm. But as queen, you could not have anyone be your master.
That's why there can be a king and a queen. Like, say when William's king, yeah, Catherine will be his queen.
Yeah.
But because he is the reigning monarch, he can have a queen. But if there's a queen, that reigning monarch can't have a king above them.
Yeah. So if it was Catherine, who is Charles's daughter, instead of William being Charles's son, then Catherine would be queen, and William, but William would never be king.
Yeah.
It's one of the things I had to change was the name.
Yeah.
As the Duke and Duchess of Edinburgh, they were Philip and Elizabeth Mountbatten, but as queen, she had to be Elizabeth Windsor. And this was a point that her grandmother, Dowager Queen Mary, made very strongly.
Yeah.
Because apparently Louis Mountbatten was quite happy that it was going to be the House of Mountbatten now.
Yeah, he even made a speech saying that the House of Mountbatten is running the country or something along those lines.
And Queen Mary.
That got back to Queen, the Dowager Queen.
Mary was Elizabeth's grandmother.
Yeah.
And No, it had to be Windsor. Always had to be Windsor.
Mm-hmm.
So she wrote a very strongly worded letter, which from a Dowager Queen is actually more terrifying than it sounds.
Yeah, it's almost like the Howler in Harry Potter.
Yeah. She basically wrote a Howler saying, no, it will be Windsor.
Yeah, but not just Elizabeth.
Yeah, all of them. So the children also had to be Windsor as well, which caused Philip to say quite a famous quote now, "I am nothing but a bloody amoeba. I am the only man in the country not allowed to give his name to his own children."
That's a massive thing.
That is sad.
So at this point, if we look back what he's done for love, changed his faith, changed his name, can't give his children his name.
Yeah, he's given up pretty much everything that makes him
individual.
Yeah, who he is. The children had to be Windsor, but Elizabeth kind of found a way around it.
Because she loved him as well. She could see the pain this was causing him and was constrained by the royal duty and the royal rules. But she found loopholes, did our Lizzie?
She did. It took a while. Like, she was trying to find a way around it, and it actually only came out, I can't remember if it's Andrew or Edward, but it was only a couple of days before he was born. In 1960, she ordered the male line of the family, not given his or her Royal Highness or titled as Prince or Princess, could take the surname Mountbatten Windsor. Only the male line, only without a title or HRH.
So it's something.
It's something. It's not a huge amount, but it is something.
That his name wouldn't die out.
Yeah, exactly. So they'd be there. But Philip still had more to give up. He had to give up his naval career. And in the coronation in 1953, he knelt before her and took her hand in his and pledged himself to his wife and queen as liege man of life and limb. So basically he's saying, I'm giving up everything and I am your man in entirety. I am your servant. He had to kneel before his wife, which was a big deal back then.
Huge. Men did not do that.
Ooh.
And that's, like, we have to look at history and see things the way they were back then. Women were not equal to men.
No.
Back then. I mean, there's still some ways to go at the moment in certain aspects of life. But back then, for a man to be like, you know what, I'm always going to walk behind you. And you make all of the decisions, you take everything away from me, but I don't care because I love you and this is what I'm doing for you.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, to have someone love you that much.
And they couldn't, in their wedding vows, say to cherish and obey.
Yeah.
Because the wife would always have to say to cherish and obey, because you have to obey your husband.
Yeah.
But she's not allowed to say that because she's the queen and she doesn't obey anyone. Everyone obeys her. Little bit gutting for him.
Philip supported the young queen through her initial duties and tours. And he actually, I love this, he walked beside her rather than behind her at the state opening of Parliament, which was unusual and a huge deal.
Yeah.
And Elizabeth was fine with that.
Yeah, in fact, she wanted it that way.
Yeah, Elizabeth made it so that, in a lot of ways, Philip would be allowed to be beside her. And he even took precedence over his own son, who was the Crown Prince of Wales, Charles.
Yeah, which he technically shouldn't have done. He should have, if anything, he either walked beside Charles or just behind Charles. It should have been Elizabeth, Charles, and Philip.
Yeah, but Elizabeth was like, nope.
Yeah, Elizabeth's like, this is my husband, this is my partner. yeah. He's walking with me. And in her Diamond Jubilee speech in 2012, Elizabeth referred to Philip as her constant strength and guide.
Mm-hmm.
And at their golden wedding anniversary in 1997, she said that she, her family and the Commonwealth owed Philip a debt greater than he would ever claim or we will ever know.
Yeah, I've seen that speech quite a lot. Because obviously since the Prince died last Friday, a week ago Friday, we've had in the UK a lot of TV specials, a lot of documentaries have been put together quickly. Some were made in, what's the word I'm looking for? They were made knowing that this would happen.
Yeah.
And they've played that Queen speech quite a lot. And I found it really, really moving because when she says it, he's just looking at her. The way they looked at each other, if you see some of these speeches, it's just like a love story of the ages and yeah. I love it so much.
My favourite one is when he's talking about marriage and he says that you need a lot of tolerance in the marriage.
Yeah.
And then he turns around and says that Elizabeth is basically one of the most tolerant people he knows. Yeah. He's just like, yep.
Yep. They were fun. Oh, I just love their love story, but we need to continue this. We can chat again when we're
later. Okay, so that is Philip as the child, as the boy, as the military soldier.
Man, yep.
As the prince.
As the husband.
So now it's Philip as the queen consort.
Yeah.
And he did a hell of a lot. So we've gone into brief detail about it, but we would recommend you look more into it.
He did so much.
Crazy, crazy busy yeah. man. Crazy. So we're gonna be brief about it, but we are still going to give you as much info as we can.
Yeah, yeah.
So he was the first member of the royal family to fly in a helicopter as chairman of the coronation committee. So he actually flew in a helicopter to go and inspect the troops and everything to make sure that everything was on point for her coronation. So the first royal to fly in a helicopter.
And that's how much he cared.
Yep.
Yep. In 1956, the Duke joined up with Kurt Hahn, who we mentioned earlier, to found the Duke of Edinburgh Award Scheme. And later that same year, he also founded the Commonwealth Study Conferences. Now, the D of E award scheme is a huge thing.
Yeah.
I know it's huge here. I didn't do it.
I didn't either.
But it is a huge thing here in the UK and obviously around the world. But yeah.
People even put it on their CV if they've been part yeah. of the D of E scheme.
And for those who don't know, just quick, it's three different levels for people between the ages, I think, of 13 and 21, I think. Mm-hmm. And you do bronze, silver and gold. And it's individual based, it's not a team based thing.
Yeah,
because obviously you have some people that are better, like say football for example, you're gonna have better footballers than you are than other people. Yeah. But in this, he wanted it so everyone worked for themselves. You get out of it what you put into it,
but also you work for yourselves for the betterment of society.
Yeah, and you do expeditions, there's charity, you have to do a certain amount of hours of charity work. Mm-hmm. I think for the gold Duke of Edinburgh scheme, in the year, you have to put in something like 120 hours of community work.
Yeah.
They are such a good idea.
It's about building that discipline, that independence, mm-hmm. that empowerment, and making people have that ideal sense of self,
yeah,
and which he had and which Kurt Hahn gave him,
yeah, and the awareness of what's important about conservation, about society, about what you can do for other people. It's awesome.
Yeah, it's awesome. Exactly. He was quite keen, obviously, still on sailing,
mm-hmm.
and he actually travelled around the world aboard the then newly commissioned Her Majesty's yacht Britannia, and he also opened the 1956 Summer Olympics in Melbourne. From the Britannia, and with that on board her, he became the first royal to cross the Antarctic Circle.
That's crazy, but yeah. He had it in his blood. He was a seaman, wasn't he? Really?
Yeah. In October 1957, he was appointed to the Queen's Privy Council for Canada, and was also an advocate for youth activity and health in Canada across the Commonwealth. And that was shaped by his years at Gordonston. Yeah. They were very, very like physical, very athletic, and it was seen that some of his remarks about youth fitness in Canada were probably a bit on the nose.
Yeah.
But when he actually sat down and spoke with Canadian officials about it, it was realised that he wasn't just using it to criticise, to say that, you know, oh, Canada's overweight or anything. He was using it to say, this is how we can improve the youth. This is mm-hmm. how we can improve that sense of fitness, that sense of self. So it was realised it was coming from a good place, just probably didn't quite word it well.
Well, he didn't care about what he said or how he said it. And that's why a lot of his non-PC comments and a lot of his gaffes, as they've become to know, happened. Because he just said it as it was. He didn't think about whether he should phrase it differently.
I suppose from his schooling, he was never taught to be a politician. He was just taught to be himself.
Yeah, definitely. In 1960, he was named as Honorary Oviatt of by Edgar Phillips, the
Archdruid.
Archdruid.
Yeah, that's a thing.
I was reading it, because obviously we research things, and I thought that was a spelling error as well.
Thanks. No, yeah, he's the Archdruid. He was the Archdruid of Wales.
That's such a cool title.
Yep.
I want to be Archdruid.
And this was a thing called the National Eisteddfod, which is basically a big druid ceremony, like arts and crafts and druidism and everything in Wales. It's massive. And he was given the title Philip Merioneth, which is in honour of his title of Earl of Merioneth. But he was given like the Welsh version of Merioneth.
That's really cool. Surname. That's very cool.
So basically he was an honorary overt, so he was kind of an acolyte-ish into the druid religion.
That's very cool.
Yep.
That's very cool. The year after that, so in 1961, he became the first royal to be interviewed on television, courtesy of Panorama, where he was asked about the Commonwealth Technical Training Week, because this was one of his many patrons.
Yep. He was also the first royal to give a press conference as well.
Yep. So all in all, Philip, like I said, he was a patron of over 800 organisations.
Probably closer to 900, apparently.
Yeah. Yeah, and was heavily involved in things concerning the environment, including the foundation of the World Wildlife Fund and the Australian Conservation Foundation.
Yeah, he's actually one of the first people to officially use the term, like the greenhouse effect, in relation to CO2 and everything in the atmosphere.
Yep.
In March 1948, he completed his first solo engagement, giving prizes at the Royal Albert Hall to the London Federation of the Boys Boxing Club Finals. So it was literally pretty much, he'd been married less than a year at that point, and he was doing his first solo stuff. He was president of the National Playing Fields Association and fellow of the Royal Society, and was president of the Industrial Society and the patron of the Industrial Society, president of the Football Association, the FA, from 1955 to 57.
Yep, that's really cool. And I found this out this morning, which I told you about, which isn't in the research, because I didn't actually know this, which is really, really bad. I'm a member of the Army Cadet Force. I have been for 10 years now. And I found out today that actually the Duke of Edinburgh was our Commander-in-Chief of the ACF from the 17th of January 1953 until the 9th of April 2021. So until the day he died, he was our Commander-in-Chief of the ACF.
Yeah.
That's really cool. I just thought that was another cool thing that he was part of.
No, it
that
is.
I didn't know.
It is pretty
I should
cool.
have known that. I probably did know. Maybe it's one of those things that I'd heard and
yeah, it's probably
forgotten.
It's like, oh yeah, the Duke of Edinburgh is their patron. You don't really twig, like, Duke of Edinburgh, yeah, yeah, Prince Philip. It doesn't sometimes twig.
Mm.
He was also, for a while, president of the Marylebone Cricket Club and BAFTA, the British Academy of Film and Television Awards.
I mean, of course he was.
Yeah, I mean, why not?
Yeah.
He was also president and a later honorary fellow of the Zoological Society of London and president of the International Equestrian Foundation. Although he did get some backlash from his animal stuff because he was still into fox hunting. Not excusing that at all, because I abhor fox hunting, I abhor blood sports. However, that is the society into which he was raised, so he was raised to believe that was acceptable.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep. He was Chancellor of Cambridge, Edinburgh, Salford and Wales Universities, and he chaired the Queen's Awards for Enterprise. He later became president of the Council of Engineering Institutions and became a senior fellow of the Royal Academy of Engineering.
With his love of the sea, he helped to found the Maritime Trust in 1970 to help preserve and restore historic British ships, and was also a patron of the British Heart Foundation.
He was an honorary fellow of St Edmund's College at Cambridge.
He did continue his duties as a husband and father with Edward and Andrew, now added to the growing family.
So there's their four children now born, Charles, Anne, Edward and Andrew.
Yeah, and little Anne as well.
Yep. Did I not say Anne?
No, you said four children and listed the three boys.
Did I swear I said Anne.
You probably, if I didn't hear you.
Oh, I said Charles Anne, and then my brain went Drew. Charles, yeah, that's what I did.
Fair enough.
Sorry, Princess Anne. I apologise. Apologies.
It's fine. It's fine. I mean, I'm saying it's fine. I'm not Anne, so yeah. She might be mortally offended if she ever listens to this. Your Highness, apologies.
Yeah.
He encouraged Charles to attend Gordonston, but Charles didn't really flourish there like his father, and he was eventually removed.
Yeah, I think Charles actually made a point of saying it was like the worst experience of his life. He hated every second of it.
Yeah, he's... I don't want to use the word soft. He's more of a sensitive soul than his father.
Yeah, but yeah, that's definitely. Because he had his mother. I think Elizabeth is more sensitive as well.
Yeah.
And his grandparents.
Yeah.
As we've seen from the beginning of this podcast, that Philip didn't have that. He was moved from everyone, everywhere, all the time.
Yeah. Thing is, Charles had to be hard. A childhood. Philip had no choice but to grow up quickly.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So Charles was eventually removed, and Philip was actually instrumental in encouraging the marriage of Charles and Lady Diana Spencer. He basically told them that they either needed to get engaged or break the courtship off because it was all just dancing around.
Mm-hmm.
And he actually gave them both a lot of support and advice and wisdom through letters when the marriage hit the rocks. He was quite disappointed in both of them for extramarital affairs.
Yeah.
But he did give them a lot of advice, and there's letters between him and Diana where she openly thanked him for that.
Yeah, and said, like, she felt he was one of the ones that understood her, helped her, and everything.
Yeah.
Eventually, Charles and Diana were divorced a year later. Diana was tragically killed in a car crash in Paris on the 31st of August, 1997.
Prince Philip and Queen Elizabeth were at the royal residence of Balmoral in Scotland when the news broke, and they had their grandsons, William and Harry, who are Diana and Charles's children, with them. They did shield William and Harry from the press and global attention at first to give them time to grieve their mother. I mean, they were boys. They were young. But Philip and Elizabeth were heavily criticised for this.
Oh, hugely.
Massively. They were called, like, the worst people on the planet, the worst monarch. How dare they do this? And it's actually the closest the monarchy has come in recent times to real danger.
Yeah. Like, I think it's a lot of the British public also felt, because they were so close, the people's princess, like Diana, they said the Queen should be in London to be there for her people. But at that time, I personally think that Elizabeth and Philip were not being Queen and Prince. They were being Nan and Grandad.
Yeah.
Definitely at that point.
Gangam.
Yep. That's what they were being. Yeah. They weren't the Queen at that point. They were a Nan and a Grandad.
I would just say, apparently, Gangam is what Prince George, when he was younger, yeah, apparently called Queen Elizabeth.
Yeah.
Which I think is adorable.
It's very sweet.
But yeah, that whole thing, it's been called the Annus Horribilis. Which means the terrible year or the horrible year.
Yeah.
And yeah, they were under a lot of stress and a lot of pressure. Elizabeth did come out and issue a statement and just basically say they were grieving, that they would be back, which I think went a long way to placate it.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, you're right. At that point, they weren't prince and queen. They were Nan and Grandad.
Yeah.
Rumours were circulated in the press afterwards, as the press do, and many still accept it as truth, that the boys were forced to walk behind their mother's coffin at her funeral. What has since come out, however, is that Prince Philip actually told William, who's the older of the two, "If you don't walk, I think you'll regret it later. If I walk, will you walk with me?" So we're not seeing a tyrannical, hard man forcing two grieving boys to follow their dead mother. Mm. What we're actually seeing is a caring grandfather encouraging them to send her off well and showing his support by walking there with them when he could so easily have been in the car with Elizabeth.
Yeah, he like, so easily could have not done that.
I mean, the Queen doesn't walk, if you've seen Philip's funeral, the Queen does not walk behind the coffin. It's just not done. So Philip could have gone in the car, mm-hmm, with her, but instead he chose to show that respect by walking behind Diana's coffin.
Yeah.
With her brother, Earl Spencer. And he offered the boys a chance to do it and basically said, if you don't do it, I think you'll regret it. It's up to you. And if I do it, will you do it with me? Because I will be there with you.
Yeah. Which is completely different to what has ever been reported.
Yeah.
It's really sad that things like that, this are coming out now that he's gone.
Yeah. I mean, I get the whole, I'm aware there may be a certain level of propaganda that we see,
yeah,
because,
yeah,
you know, don't speak ill of the dead. But there's also going to be a lot coming out of truth that we didn't know. It's going to prompt people to research as well, like us,
mm-hmm,
who didn't know a lot about this man and are going to be shocked at,
yeah,
who and what he was.
Definitely. And I think it's because, like I was saying to you earlier, people our age, we're 30s and younger, we've never known Philip as a properly acting, working royal. Because when we were born, he was in his 70s.
Yeah, he was starting to slow down at that
point. Yeah, so we wouldn't have ever seen him do all this amazing stuff.
No.
So we don't learn about it. We just hear about this cranky old man who says stupid things and offends people. That's how we've been portrayed.
He's kind of like, the way I described him once is like that granddad that you know he's going to be funny, but every time he opens his mouth in company, you cringe.
Yeah, and you know that if you ask someone to tell you a joke, you know his is going to be filth.
Yeah, but charity man, conservationist, economist, engineer, scientist, teacher, husband, father.
Soldier.
There's so much more to him.
Yeah.
However, conspiracies do still abound about the whole Diana thing.
Yeah, and we're not going to discuss them here because we have our own views.
Yeah. All we are going to say is that after an inquest in 2008, there was no evidence of a conspiracy found.
Mm-hmm.
Make of that what you will, but the people who are saying that Prince Philip, like, they blame the royal family, but they also blame Prince Philip directly for it. So there was no conspiracy found. We have our opinions. Everyone's entitled to an opinion.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Yeah, but we are probably never going to know the truth either way.
No.
So it's just one of those things that whilst, you know,
tragic and it was tragic, horrific,
yeah,
and that should just be where it is.
Yeah, exactly. Let's just leave it at that.
Yeah.
So now we're coming to the bit that we are aware of, because I see we were like, what, eight, nine when Diana died?
Yeah.
Yeah. So this is the point, this is the Philip that we know.
Yeah.
And this is the Philip that's starting to wind down.
Mm-hmm.
In April 2009, Philip officially became the longest-serving consort in British royal history and the oldest ever male British royal in February 2013. He was also the third longest-lived member of the British royal family and was only just pipped to the post by Elizabeth the Queen Mother, aged 101 when she died, and Alice, Duchess of Gloucester, who was aged 102 when she died.
So the royals know how to live ripe old ages.
So basically, he is the longest, he's the third longest living and the longest living male.
Yeah.
He'll keep that unless Elizabeth pips him.
Yeah. However, he is reported to have said that he didn't want to live that long, as bits of me are falling off already.
Sounds about right.
Yeah.
He also was plagued by ill health from about 2008 onwards.
Yeah.
And he had a string of chest and bladder infections.
Yeah, he was in hospital quite a lot with the bladder infections.
Yeah, which, I mean, for someone of our age, it's going to be really unpleasant. But for someone of his age, from 70 onwards,
it's dangerous.
It could be fatal.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, and there was even a rumour of prostate cancer at one point, which was created by the Evening Standard. But it's not like the royals to come out and comment on medical conditions.
Mm-hmm.
But on this one they did. They came out and just basically flat out refuted it. And the paper was forced to print a retraction.
Yep. Prince Philip announced on his 90th year that he would be starting to reduce his duties. I think he'd earned that.
I mean, he was retiring at the age of 90. Most
However,
people were dead by then.
Even though he retired, that same year he was given another title.
Mm-hmm.
He was Lord High Admiral, and this was given to him by Queen Elizabeth.
That's basically like a recognition of thank you so much for everything you've done. This is like, you are Navy, so you are the Navy now.
Yeah, you are the Navy.
Yes.
Philip was operated on, he had some conditions, at Papworth Hospital, just down the road in Cambridge. This was for chest pains, and he had a cardioangioplasty and a stent fitted.
Yeah. So, considering, like, he was in his 90s at that point, whew, that was a tricky, risky operation. I would have wanted to be that surgeon.
Oh, could you imagine?
He did later contract a bladder infection and had to be taken to the hospital in June 2012. The infection then came back in August whilst the family were at Balmoral, and he had to be admitted to hospital again. He underwent a minor procedure in 2014 on his right hand and was later discharged. So, some photos around about in 2014, you'll see him on his right hand with a little bandage and everything on it. That was because of an operation he had.
Possibly carpal tunnel. That's the normal things they do on hands, isn't it?
Could be, yeah. Especially because he writes a lot, doesn't he?
Yeah.
So, yeah, could be.
Yep. Another infection laid him low in June 2017 when he was forced to miss out on supporting his wife at the state opening of Parliament, and he missed the opening of Royal Ascot that year.
The first time.
Yep.
From, like, marriage in 1947 to 2017, the first time he'd missed anything. And since she'd been queen in 1952, the first time he'd missed the state opening of Parliament.
Yeah.
In August 2017, so probably as a result of that, Philip officially retired from royal duty. So he was winding down in when he turned 90, but it wasn't until 2017 he officially retired. His last solo engagement was a meeting of Royal Marines on the 2nd of August. And at this point, he was 96 and had carried out over 22,000 solo engagements since becoming Queen Consort in 1952.
That's an insane amount.
That's busy.
That's an insane amount.
That's very, very, very busy.
In 2017, he was with Elizabeth when she became the first reigning monarch to celebrate a platinum wedding anniversary, which is being married for 70 years.
Yeah. So, like, being married for far longer than you had been with that person, to have them longer than you'd not had them.
That's a lot longer than you'd not had them.
That's nearly, I mean, what, she was 21 when she got married?
Mm-hmm.
70 years. So that's nearly four times as long. It's just the...
It
doesn't compute.
I can't comprehend not only being married to someone that long, but actually knowing somebody that long. Imagine turning around and saying we've been friends for 70 years. It's such a number.
I can barely believe we've been friends for like 12.
It's such a number.
I think you'd kill Ben long before you got to 70 years.
Oh, Christ, yeah.
In April 2018, so the following April, Philip underwent a hip replacement operation, quite common around that age.
96, yeah.
Quite common in your latter years. But he actually seemed to be recovering well, and he was actually able to accompany Elizabeth unaided, which is a big deal for a hip operation, to the wedding of Prince Harry and the American actress Meghan Markle. He later accompanied her again to the wedding of another grandchild, Princess Eugenie, to Jack at Brooks Bank.
Yep, so he went to both their weddings.
Yep.
Which again, I think at that point, he was going as granddad.
Yeah.
And he was going to be there.
Yeah.
And he went, and it's lovely.
Oh, Grandpa Phil.
Yep. On the 17th of January 2019, the then 97-year-old Philip was involved in a car crash as he pulled out onto a main road near the Sandringham Estate in Norfolk. Now, on that time, I was working as a journalist in Norfolk for a newspaper called the Eastern Daily Press. And I reported on this. There is a couple of pictures around of this. I was the one who took the phone call. We had someone call up our offices anonymously. We'd heard about a crash in Sandringham. It was on a road on Babbingley. It was pulling out of a junction. Basically, if I paint the picture, you've got a long road and you've got little roads that can pull out into it. Mm-hmm. Like you've got a main road with smaller roads that come onto it.
That's quite common around here.
Yeah. And he was pulling out and it was quite a sunny day. And he claims that the sun was in his eyes. It was really sunny, reflecting. He didn't see a car coming from the opposite direction. He didn't see because of the sun glare. And he pulled out into another car.
Okay.
We got a call that somebody anonymous said the guy in the car crash was Prince Philip.
Right.
That was what he said. The guy wouldn't give his name, or anything. But then my colleague ran out and got some pictures of Philip's Land Rover. It was on its side.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, a passerby pulled Prince Philip out of the sunroof.
Yeah.
That's how he had to get out of the car, out the sunroof. And those pictures were the two that Chris got were the only ones. They've been circulated around the globe. So any pictures you've seen of a green Land Rover on its side on the back of a tow truck were taken because I got the phone call.
Nice.
Yeah. My little claim to fame. Prince Philip, however, was uninjured, though this was disputed and the occupants of the other vehicle were taken to hospital, but that was because of a precaution.
Yeah, because they were the vehicle that was hit, weren't they?
Yeah.
And Philip was in the vehicle that did the hitting.
Yeah.
Yeah. we say it's disputed because the official press release from Buckingham Palace or from Sandringham was that he was unharmed. However, the person that pulled him out of the car said that they had blood on their hands,
mm-hmm.
which could have potentially been like if his airbag went off, he could have had a bloody nose or something like that. But
or cut himself when he crawled out of the glass out of the sunroof.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
But yeah, it was quite a time. It was quite a time. A massive story blown about a royal. Many phone calls, had to ring the press office. Did you know that the press every member of the royal family has their own press office?
That and doesn't surprise me, being involved.
And their own liaison. So when you ring the press office at Buckingham Palace, you have to ask which member of the royal family's press office you want. So I had to ring the press office of Prince Philip,
mm-hmm.
because it's completely different. And obviously they were like, we have no comment at this moment in time. I was like... obviously. And then the next day, it was ice, it was freezing in Norfolk, and there was journalists from all around the country on that tiny little bit of road. There was glass from the Land Rover on the pathway, and I had to take pictures of this glass, and it was just like...
I remember because you messaged me, because I was at work at that point.
It was like 8 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah, and you messaged me going, I'm standing here and I'm waiting, it's absolutely freezing, and I have to stand outside the car, and it's so very, very cold, and look at all these people, and you were sending me the video, and like, I can't even have my coffee, because my coffee's in the car, but I've got to stay outside of the car.
Yeah. And there was people from like ITV News and BBC News, and I was crossing over to take a picture, and they were like, excuse me, we're going on air in 5 seconds, you're going to be in the shot, so I had to run away, and...
To be fair,
it was insane. Yeah.
You would have been fairly visible in your very purple coat.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not a journalist anymore. I work in IT. I realised that journalism wasn't for me, but that was
that's your claim to fame.
It will stick in my mind, definitely.
Yeah. In fairness to him, as a response to this, Philip did issue a formal apology.
Yeah, he admitted that. It was his fault.
Yeah. He also voluntarily surrendered his driving licence. So he's not allowed to drive on public roads, but he was allowed to drive on private estates. But he voluntarily surrendered his driving licence.
At 97, probably a good idea.
Wasn't enough, though. The owners of the other vehicle did try to prosecute. How much of that was because of injury or just because of who it was?
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, that's our personal opinion. But the Crown Prosecution Service, the CPS, decided it wouldn't be in the public interest to pursue this, and the case was dropped. The press did have a field day with it, but the case was dropped.
Yeah, and we are quite lucky because we live in King's Lynn, we've said before. We live a 10-minute drive from Sandringham.
Yeah.
And when Philip did, from like 20, when he was 90 and he stepped back, he spent a lot more time in Sandringham, to the point that since 2017, he probably spent 80% of his year in Norfolk.
Yeah.
We didn't know, but he was here, driving around until, obviously, this.
Although, the last couple of months he's been in London because he's had to have... at Windsor, because he's had to have his operation.
Since COVID, they've stayed in London.
Yeah.
Wills and Kate haven't. William and Kate have been here.
Yeah.
Shopping in the Range.
Yeah. You just... Randomly you just go into the shop and you're like, okay, there's our future queen. Hi.
Yeah. And
hi.
King and George wanted this wooden aeroplane from the Range, and someone saw it, and then loads of people from King's Lynn went to the Range to buy the same toy for their child for Christmas that Kate had just bought for Prince George.
It's a bit mad.
Yeah.
But imagine, you know, when you're in a supermarket and you get that person that's just standing there for ages in front of the very thing that you want, and you've got to pretend to be perusing something next to it. It's weird enough when you do that and it's just a normal person, especially now in COVID, because you can't get close, so you've got to pretend to, I don't know, be looking at
anything.
Like cooked meats when all you really want is pepperoni.
Yeah.
And it's like you're waiting, trying to not make it creepy. But how do you try and not make it creepy when it's Kate Middleton, future queen, standing there? You're like, I'm not here because you're Kate Middleton. I'm here because I really, really want to look at that teapot set, but you're standing in front of it.
Yeah. She was here as it was only just before this lockdown eased. So I think you're talking at the beginning of March, they were in the Range at King's Lynn.
Yeah.
Like, they spent most of their time here. But yeah, so that's why that was a big thing. But
come to King's Lynn, the future queen shops at the Range and Stephen Fry shops at the local Tesco.
Yep.
Yeah.
They just love Norfolk.
Yeah,
anyway.
Anyway.
Because he gave up his licence, obviously, Philip, like you said, wasn't allowed to drive on public roads. It was only on private estates, and their Sandringham estate has got a lot of private areas, so he probably still drove around.
Yeah. Yeah, and there's still photos of him behind the wheel at Sandringham, which is, you know, that's fine. It's private. He can't hurt anyone.
Yep.
He did go into hospital again in December 2019, and then he and Elizabeth isolated during COVID at Windsor and Sandringham.
Mm-hmm. In July 2020, he officially resigned as Colonel-in-Chief of the Rifles, and he passed the baton on to the Duchess of Cornwall, Camilla, who is Prince Charles's wife now.
In January 2021, it was publicised that both Elizabeth and Philip had been successfully vaccinated against COVID-19 at Windsor Castle. However, in February, Philip was admitted to hospital after feeling unwell. It's unlikely that it was the effects of COVID.
Yeah.
He was probably something completely different. Mm-hmm. Charles visited his father and said that he was doing well.
He did seem to be in hospital a long time this time. On March the 1st, 2021, Philip was taken by an ambulance to St Bartholomew's Hospital to be treated for an infection and to be observed regarding a heart condition. And then again, on the 3rd of March, he had to have heart surgery. This was successful, and he was later then transferred and then discharged from King Edward VII Hospital in London on the 16th of March. So you're looking at 6-7 weeks in hospital, which is quite... Considering the amount of times he's been in hospital, I don't remember him being in for that long period of time.
Yeah, it didn't feel like that long at the time. It really didn't. But he was in and out and in and out, and then he was discharged. And then it was just kind of...
There were pictures of him when he discharged. He did not look okay.
He didn't.
And it has kind of came out that it's possible that he knew he was going to die and he came home to die.
Yeah.
It's been reported. Like we said, we don't know how much... is the truth, but it has been reported that in the hospital he was told that he wasn't long for this world and to go home and be with his family.
And then at 12 noon on the 9th of April 2021, the news broke that Prince Philip had passed away that morning at Windsor Castle, aged 99. And the cause of death has been undisclosed and is likely to remain that way. Mm-hmm. But it is said to have been peaceful. His daughter Anne actually described it as he went in his sleep and it was like someone had taken his hand and said, come on, let's go, and he'd just gone.
Yep.
Which is all you can ask for, really.
Elizabeth is reported to have said that his death has left a huge void in her life. And the saddest thing, and honestly thinking about it gets me choked up,
yeah,
was seeing her standing alone in St George's Chapel yesterday, the 17th of April, at his funeral. I mean, I'm tearing up now. It was the most horrendous thing.
She travelled behind in a car, accompanied, but then she was taken into St George's Chapel. And the rest of the family followed on behind. There was a couple of people, like the wives, the consorts and everything, were there. But she was there, closest to the coffin, at the front, completely on her own, whilst her husband of 73 years was being carried in.
And that the picture, you've probably seen it all over social media, of her sitting in the pews. It is so haunting.
Yeah.
And...
I mean, you remarked that her hat was really, really perfect because the brim of the hat was quite long, so you couldn't see her head. But honestly, head was bowed.
The mask got to her nose. The hat was to the bottom of her nose, so she could cry. She could do whatever she needed. And I just thought it was, like, obviously it's COVID and there's loads of people that have had to go through the same thing.
Yeah.
They've lost loved ones and had to be on their own. And she wouldn't have wanted it any other way. She wouldn't have wanted special treatment because she's the queen. But it is just the thought of her. She's now, not only was she alone then, she now is so alone. How she must be feeling.
Yeah, as you said earlier, and it was poignant when you said it. There's a few moments throughout this where we've mentioned they weren't Philip and Elizabeth, Prince and Queen.
Yeah.
They were just Philip and Elizabeth.
Yeah.
And you said in that moment she wasn't Queen Elizabeth, she was Lilibet.
Yeah.
Yeah. And she just said goodbye to her husband and it was just like, yeah.
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 I don't really know what to say because we watched it and because, like I said, we are royalists and I don't think... And no disrespect to her at all, I don't think she looked like Queen Elizabeth. Because normally when we've seen her go to royal occasions, she's always standing tall, her head is up, she's looking incredible.
As tall as she can be, she's quite short.
Yeah, like she still looked incredible, like what she wore was beautiful. The brooch that she had, she looked beautiful.
Mm.
But she looked like, you'd expect a woman who just lost her husband.
She looked like an elderly widow.
Yeah, and it was, honestly, I just don't, what she must be feeling, how she must be feeling.
There's no words for it.
No.
And, like, our hearts go out to to his family, his kids and his grandkids. But they had no choice in who their father was.
No.
She chose him. She chose him to spend her life with, and now he's gone.
And they had, like I said at the beginning, their love story.
Yeah.
What the sacrifices he made, the things that she went up against to make sure that he had a place, he had a voice, he had something to do.
Yeah.
But she pushed against the royal rules that have been in place for hundreds of years here in the UK to make sure that he felt as individual as being her partner could. And it is beautiful. It really is a love story that will transcend the ages because it was beautiful.
Yeah, it's so sad on that level that she's lost him now. But she gave him that chance to leave such a legacy behind.
Oh, God.
And to have work that's continuing on and will continue on long after him.
Mm-hmm.
Like, by encouraging him to be himself as much as possible.
Yeah.
She gave us so much by letting him give us so much.
Yeah.
So, thank you.
Yeah, definitely. But he is likely to be remembered a lot for his non-PC comments and his dry sense of humour.
Yeah. But did you know he was a talented artist?
Mm.
There's some things of his that are hanging up at Buckingham Palace, including a watercolour of the Queen at breakfast.
Mm.
Which is pretty cute. He was a conservationist, and he's described by those who knew him as a down-to-earth man with an imposing presence that he could turn on or off at will. And apparently he could give you a really, really bad side eye when you'd done something wrong, which would be terrifying.
Yeah.
He also coined the word dontopedology as the science of opening your mouth and putting your foot in it, a science which I have practiced for a good many years.
That's pretty apt for Prince Philip.
Yeah, I mean, he knew it and he laughed about it.
Yeah.
He knew he was going to say these things, but he's like, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
Whatever.
He was focused on education, and he actually presented a number of television shows to educate children about science, technology, and the countries of the Commonwealth. Can you imagine now, like, Prince Harry or Prince William just doing a TV show for kids about conservation?
So I would love to see, like, Prince William doing something like the
right.
Sky at Night with Professor Brian Cox.
But did you... I didn't know that Philip had done
no.
that. That's how much he cared.
That was... I mean, you'd actually be more likely to get William and Harry doing it, but imagine, like, King George doing it.
Yeah.
Or someone. That would be insane.
It was a huge deal for back then.
It really was. A lot of the stories about him are either exaggerated or invented outright by the press.
Yeah.
Within the funeral, interviews with his former director of personal security, he recanted a story where it was in the papers that Philip had said something dodgy or racist, and the director of security actually remarked that he'd been with Philip the whole day and hadn't heard him say it at all. And Philip apparently acknowledged this and basically said that he might as well own it if he's been accused of it.
Yeah.
Which is sad in a way. It's just like, the press are going to say what they're going to say. I might as well own it, you know what? Yeah, whatever.
Yep. Philip suffered a lot of loss in his life. That was said from losing his sister and his two nephews in the plane crash in Germany, to losing his home and livelihood as an infant in Greece. His mother, Alice, passed away in 1969 at Buckingham Palace, however. She was being allowed to spend her final days with her son and his family.
Yeah.
His father, Andrew, passed away in 1944 in Monte Carlo, having not seen Philip since 1939 because of the Second World War.
Yeah, so for 5 years he hadn't seen his father, and then he learns his father had passed away.
Yeah.
One of the worst losses, though, was his beloved uncle and firm friend, Louis Mountbatten, the first Earl Mountbatten of Burma. He shared his nephew's love of the sea and had his own distinguished naval career. On the 27th of August 1979, whilst on holiday at his summer home of Classybourne Castle in Mullamore, County Sligo in Ireland, Louis was fishing on his boat, the Shadow Five. The night before, IRA terrorist, so Irish Republican Army terrorist, Thomas McMahon had snuck on board and placed a radio-controlled 23-kilogram bomb. Barely a few hundred yards from shore on that fateful day, the bomb was detonated, destroying the boat. Mountbatten survived the blast, but nearly lost both of his legs. He was pulled to the shore, but later succumbed to his injuries. Also on board were his daughter Patricia, her husband Lord Brabourne, their two twin sons Nicholas and Timothy, and Lord Brabourne's mother and a young crewman named as Paul Maxwell. Nicholas, who was 14, and Paul, who was 15, were killed in the blast. Doreen, Dowager Lady Brabourne, also succumbed to her injuries, as did Louis. So in one single act, Philip had lost his uncle slash father figure and his young nephew. Gone. Completely gone.
Yeah. But in 2011, Elizabeth and Philip made a state visit to the Republic of Ireland, being the first reigning monarch to visit the area since it had become a republic. As part of this, they met with the then Prime Minister.
Or Taoiseach in Gaelic.
Does that mean Prime Minister?
Yeah.
Ah, cool.
Basically. It's their word for Prime Minister, Taoiseach. Oh, or okay. Taoiseach, if it's plural.
Oh, that's fun. Met with Fine Gael member Edna Kenny and President Mary McLeese.
McLeese.
Close. Cheers. On day four of the visit, they then met with Michael Brown, Sinn Féin Mayor of Cashel, County Tipperary, and they shook hands.
Yeah, this was pretty significant because for those who aren't familiar with Irish politics, basically, after 1916, there was an Easter uprising and Ireland, the bottom part of Ireland became the Republic of Ireland. And then you've got the north part, Northern Ireland, so like from County Neary up, that's part of the UK still. But there's a sect called the IRA, the Irish Republican Army, who are basically terrorists. One man's terrorist is another man's freedom fighter, whatever. But they use violent, underhand, terrorist tactics to try and create a unified Ireland. And it caused a lot of problems, and we had a lot of... it was the thing called the Troubles, where you had North v South, Catholic v Protestant. It was bloody, it was violent, it was unnecessary, and it was just a black mark on Irish history. And it was ended, sort of ended, by the Good Friday Agreement in the late 90s. But no British monarch had set foot in there. And one of the political parties that supported it was the Sinn Féin Party. And one of their most famous leaders is Gerry Adams, who was the leader during the Good Friday Agreement. And Michael Brown, as part of the Sinn Féin Party, had strong links to the IRA. The IRA being the ones who killed Louis Mountbatten.
Mm-hmm.
But Philip shook his hand.
That's a huge deal.
Yeah. It would be, you know, I mean, to all intents and purposes, Louis was basically his father figure.
Oh, yeah.
So it would be like having to shake hands with the person who killed your father.
Mm-hmm.
And I know Michael Brown, well, I don't know, I'm fairly sure, Michael Brown had no direct involvement in it.
Mm-hmm.
But he's still part of that organisation that's related to it. They are still associated with the Provisional IRA, who are kind of still going at the moment, and some of you may be aware there are some things starting up again with the recent issue with Brexit and the hard border. There's issues, there's trouble starting again between North and South, which we do not want.
No, there's no need.
No.
But like you said before, there are people that are going to support it. Like you said, what was it, the one man's enemy is another man's freedom fighter?
Yeah. I mean, I'm... personal opinion here, I am all for a unified Ireland, but I'm aware that I understand why they wanted to leave the United Kingdom, because there was a lot of stuff which we might cover at a later point, including but not limited to the Irish potato famine, that we might cover in another podcast that would kind of explain why. But this is not the way to go about it.
Mm-mm.
At all. No.
No.
So, that was Prince Philip.
My God, what a life.
Very, very busy.
What a life.
Like, 10 pages worth of busy.
But also, like, I can't.
How did we not know all this?
I knew barely anything.
I didn't know he did that much charity work. I genuinely thought he was just a cantankerous old goat that occasionally made me laugh because he was very on PC and didn't care.
Yeah, and I knew, obviously, he did the DV Awards.
Yeah, we knew that. But I didn't realise, I thought that was just set up in his name. I didn't realise he was actually
instrumental
in setting it up. Yeah.
Yeah.
And so sorry, Your Highness, that I misunderstood you for all these years. Genuinely, I'm sorry.
So glad that it's coming out now.
Yeah.
I had no idea. He's lived the most incredible life. Mm-hmm. He's leaving the most extraordinary legacy behind.
And everything that happened to him, it could have made him bitter. It could have made him angry. But he still wanted to support his wife, to support his family, to try and make her country, his adopted country, a better place.
Yeah.
And the world a better place.
And whatever you think about the royal family, they do a lot of good. For all the bad that people may think they do a lot of good. But charities that they are part of, that they've been created, the money that is generated because of them, the money that they give, the inspiration, the everything. It's so much more than just the name.
Yeah. It's, yeah, from what we've learned from Philip now, I'm starting to question how much of it is what we actually know is truth and how much of it is what we are led to believe.
Mm-hmm.
Which is a shame. But the best way to know about someone is to have stories about them. And I'll admit, I don't have any stories about Prince Philip. I've been lucky enough to meet Charles and Camilla, who were absolutely lovely. But I've not met Prince Philip. However, someone in this room knows someone who has, don't they, Em?
Yeah, obviously, we normally, if you're listening to our podcast, well, you know we end usually with like a ridiculous death, ridiculous survival.
It didn't seem
It is not appropriate for this. So we're going to give you a couple of stories.
Yeah, a ridiculous story.
Yeah. Not ridiculous. You say you've never met them. Actually, two of my family members have.
Uh-huh.
My little sister, Mary, she actually was working, part of her college course was doing the food for an event that Prince Philip was going to in King's Lynn.
Mm-hmm.
And my sister made him and served him a dry martini.
Nice.
Yep, she said she'd never been so scared walking this martini over to the prince. She was like, and she had to be like, here I serve your martini. He's like, thank you very much, and took it and drank it.
Congratulations, Mary, you intoxicated the queen consort.
Yes, but now this funny story, my dad. My dad is a plumbing and heating engineer here in Norfolk, he owns his own business. Around Norfolk, they were going...
Bush heating, FYI.
They were doing... Obviously, they live on Sandringham, and there's lots of space. They used to go shooting. We've said this, they go shooting. Yeah. And that still happens in Norfolk, but just like pheasant, duck, like bird shooting.
Which are reared for that specific purpose.
They were doing that, but because of how where they shoot is away from the main area, they make little huts along the route. And my dad was plumbing some toilets and like sink areas and places to put in to make cups of tea and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So my dad should be able to use the royal thing at his business. He doesn't, but he should. Anyway, he was putting this in. He didn't know. There's no toilets here yet. He hadn't plumbed the toilets in. So my dad found the thing that men can do, you know, pee in different places. My dad found a tree or a bush near it and was having a wee. While he stood there, doing his business, a Land Rover came round the corner, almost hitting him, and it was Prince Philip. Prince Philip saw my dad peeing and almost hit him with a Land Rover.
Which is probably round about the time he could have surrendered his driving license, really.
Yeah, so he kind of then, he didn't get out of the van then, he just carried on driving. Then later on that day, Prince Philip came to see the work being done and stood and were just having a chat with my dad. Didn't know this until the day Prince Philip died. Like, we were talking to my dad and he was like, did you know I saw Prince Philip once? He saw me peeing. And we were like, excuse me, you need to describe this story. You need to expand. I mean, he said he just had this chat with Prince Philip for ages about different things around Sandringham, about the work my dad was doing. I don't think peeing in the bush was brought up. Maybe Prince Philip didn't see him, but my dad definitely saw Prince Philip in the car while he was having a wee.
And there we have it, ladies and gentlemen, the story of the prince and the peer. Wow. Just wow.
I mean, I don't think Prince Philip would have massively cared.
I mean, you say that, but earlier on they were talking about, because I watched a funeral yesterday and you watched it.
I was catching up on him today, yeah.
And I just remember you messaged me saying, they were just talking about how Prince Philip was like planting all these trees with Alan Titchmarsh. I was like, I wonder if that's where he went back to talk to my dad, because he'd saw my dad peeing up a tree he planted. He probably would have thanked him for watering it.
Exactly right.
Apparently ammonia does help trees, does help plants sometimes.
So yeah. That's fun. So that's how we're going to end this podcast. A laugh and lots of memories and love. And I, for one, am going to be making sure anyone who will listen knows the extraordinary life and the man that was Prince Philip.
Yeah, definitely. Elizabeth was right. We owe him a debt that he will never say, and, well, obviously he won't say now.
Mona.
And that we will never know, because even though we've covered as much as we can, I'm pretty sure this isn't half of it.
No.
Not at all.
So, rest in peace, sir.
And thank you.